Hello, and welcome to Mega City Book Club, a podcast dedicated to the collected editions, old and new, from 2000 AD and Rebellion Publishing. I'm Eamon Clark, and each episode I'm joined by a different guest who chooses the book we're going to discuss. And this time, it's my first recurring guest, back by popular demand, no less. It's Pete Wells again.
Hello!
Hello, Pete. How are you, sir?
Fantastic. What do you mean, back? You've had us locked in your cellar since the last one.
Yes, but we don't talk about that, no. They've paid the ransom. We've let you out.
Thank you.
It's all wonderful. So how have you been recently, Pete?
Absolutely fantastic. Full of the joys of 2000 AD.
So as you've come back for a second time, I can't ask you your 2000 AD origin story. So instead, what's your most recent 2000 AD acquisition? Something that's really made your heart sing.
I got that beautiful, beautiful Mezcor Dread Loremaster.
Oh, right.
And it instantly transformed us into an eight-year-old child, where I was actually sort of playing with it on me tummy, on the carpet, going rah, rah, rah. And it even makes the noises when you press the buttons. And my wife was just looking at us with even more disgust than normal.
So it lights up, it makes noises. It's very exciting looking in the videos that I've seen.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And it really does just transform you to being a child again. It could be an AT-AT or a Star Wars toy. It felt like that again. And I'm a big toy collector anyway. But this was really, really special. This is something I've wanted all my life. And soon we'll be getting a 3-year one on top. So it's like a bus, isn't it? I've waited all my life.
And then three have come along all at once. Because the Mezco one comes in two colours, I think, doesn't it? There's the blue and a black, is that right?
Yes, that's right. And some idiots have bought both.
Well, no doubt the seller of Dread has acquired both. In fact, I know he has, because I've seen the videos.
And so is the House of Pete.
It has, is it? That's right.
Yeah. But if Mrs. Pete ever listens to this, of course, each one cost me £20.
They're very reasonably priced, and they are lovely looking things. As you say, childish delight to see them lighting up and making all the noises.
Yeah. And an acquisition that's in the post. I've got a commission coming through from Ben Wilshire, which I'm very excited about, and I don't even know what it's going to be.
Oh, exciting.
So keep your eyes open to see what that is.
Excellent. We look forward to seeing that popping up on your Facebook page.
Yep.
All right, Pete, so tell us, what are we going to be talking about this episode? What's the book you've chosen this time after the sort of like rollicking success of America last time?
It's my very, very favourite non-Dread story. It's Button Man, Get Harry X.
So it's the collected edition Get Harry X, which collects all three Button Man stories, or the first three books anyway.
The Ranson collection, we could call it.
That's it, yes, the Ranson collection, very good. So just quickly, the credits, book one, Prog 780 to 791, that was 1992. Book two, 904 to 919, and that was 1994. And then up to 2001 with book three that ran from Progs 1223 to 1233, I think. All written, of course, by...
my hero, Mr. John Wagner.
And with beautiful art, as you say, from Arthur Ranson throughout all three books that we've got collected together. And I'll just do the invisible art, the letterers. Tom Frame, the late and great Tom Frame on the first book. David Bishop and Steve Potter on book two. And then Ellie DeVille lettered book three. Lovely to see them. But of course, I think we're going to be talking about Wagner and Ranson, aren't we, Pete?
Yeah. But wow, I never realised that Bishop had done book, or parts of book two.
Yes, I know.
I never knew he'd lettered. Wow.
I know. I was strange to see it pop up as a credit, but there he is. Yes.
Wow. So the reason that I chose this book, as I said, it's my absolute favourite non-Dread book. John Wagner, just at the top of his game. I think I hadn't seen many Wagner sort of contained stories. I've adored the long game that he's played with Dread and the characterisation in that. But to see something that was grounded sort of 30 seconds into our future, I think was how it was sold. And to be a self-contained story, it just blew us away. It was perfect, and it was so realistic that it was something that could actually happen. And I think that's why I loved it so much. But his characterization and his writing is as strong as it's ever been throughout this tale. And the character of Harry is just amazing. He's a real anti-hero. So where Dredd can be a bit of a bastard, Harry is a cold fish.
He's a very, very cold fish indeed, yes. Isn't he? Yes, he's the complete article, isn't he? Yes, so as you say, it's an interesting choice for 2000 AD because it's sort of very, as you say, just 30 seconds away from our world, really, isn't it? It's very close to our world. You could almost, as you say, see this happening. In fact, I'm, you know, horrors to think that it might have happened somewhere like this. It's a theme that's been sort of, I suppose, done over the years of the most dangerous game, isn't it?
Yeah.
But here you are. So tell us, what's the basic idea behind Button Man? What is a Button Man?
A Button Man is a player in a game of death, like a modern day gladiator who is controlled by someone extremely rich and famous known as a voice, and they can be politicians or the absolute establishment who get the kicks out of having the little man running around killing each other and putting bets on it. And so Harry Exton, an ex-mercenary, gets recruited into the game by his friend Carl. And we get to see him have his fights against the various other button men, all of them sort of perfectly written. There's not a redeemable character in the entire series, I think. They're just all absolutely horrible men. So Harry himself is, as we said, very cold, psychotic at times. But the people who control the game are even worse, I think, are more chilling than that. So the writing in all of the books is wonderful. But Arthur Ranson's sort of very realistic artwork elevates it again and makes the story look like it could be happening now in our world, as we said. What's beautiful about this book is that it is split into three very distinct books. The first of which takes place in England and is a very kind of small-scale tale, and a beautiful study of England through the art.
Yes, we see some lovely sort of... he's very good. Arthur Ranson's very good at scenery, and he's also very good, I thought, at the sort of the wildlife.
Yes.
Yeah, you get these amazing sequences. I noticed early on when Harry is on his farm, he's living on this sort of... rundown farm at the start of book one when he's recruited, and there's a sequence when he's on the phone, I think, to his voice, because they're, as you say, they're only voices on a telephone, aren't they?
Yep.
And there's a spider's web, I think, in the foreground, and you think, yep, you know, when I read it again this time, I thought, oh yes, you know, there's a web he's been drawn into
very much. And then a bit later on you see an owl catch a mouse, sort of just as he agrees to do another game, I think.
Yes.
And then when later on in the book Harry starts to fight back, you see a kind of sequence of a badger and a snake.
That's right, yes. He's very good on these little...
It's so good.
Nature watch vignettes of animals attacking or hunting animals, yeah. There's a hunter and prey thing going on throughout, isn't there?
Very much, yeah. Even at the end of the first book, there's a black panther that's quite sort of prominent in the doctor's office, which I'm sure we'll speak about. And Harry's there with his kind of black leather jacket on, and it just sort of fits, the imagery fits quite beautifully. Going back to Arthur Ranson's art, it's just wonderfully cinematic, isn't it? Like, I could see this book, and it's supposed to be currently being developed for television, but I could see this as a fantastic television programme.
Yes, I mean, people often talk about various comics being cinematic, but I don't think I've ever seen anything that sort of like so obviously screamed cinema as Button Man, because it is, it just, it's almost you know, crying out to be these images are crying out to be filmed, really, aren't they? I mean, it's amazing stuff, really.
It really is, yes. And apparently Spielberg has had the rights for a long, long time.
Yes, they're with DreamWorks, aren't they? That's Spielberg's company, isn't it? Yes.
And last we heard, it had been greenlit, I think, on Arthur Ranson's site. Sort of announced it's been greenlit, so we'll have to cross our fingers for that. Another thing that I think Arthur's so brilliant with in the book, and I'm sure it's come from the script as well, is there are times of absolute paranoia where the Button Man could be anyone in the crowd, or, you know, you'll have a car goes past or a helicopter flies overhead, and you, as you're reading, you tap into that beautiful paranoia of, is this going to be the next Button Man? Is this going to be the one that gets him?
Yes, Wagner and Ranson actually do that very well, I think, throughout the three books.
Mm-hmm.
They pull the rug from out of us on a number of occasions. And, you know, when reading it again, I'd forgotten. And, you know, you don't see some of the Button Men coming at all, do you?
No. Or women.
Exactly. And they sneak up on Harry and they sneak up on us.
Yeah. One thing that it blows my mind now, twice in my life, Wagner has pulled the rug from under my feet. And in hindsight, you think, how on earth did I not see that coming? So the very famous one was The Dead Man.
Oh, yes, which we talked about briefly last time, yeah.
And then he did it again with The Doctor. I'm sure when I read it first time as a 20-year-old young man, I didn't get that The Doctor was the voice, so we'll talk through the structure of Book One. Or we'll talk about it now. So Harry turns up at this doctor's office, bleeding to death, and he begins to tell him his story about this, the rich and powerful manipulating these people. And of course, by the end of Book One, you discover that the doctor that he's sort of confessing to is his voice. And there are so many clues throughout the book. And I think it's because we'll have read it episodically. And I suppose this is one of the benefits, I think, of reading an anthology and reading our stories episodically the way we do in our 5 or 6 page little chunks, that I think the writers can drop the little crumbs. And then when you read the next part the next week, that clue might be at the back of your mind and it might not be as obvious. But I remember that about 3/4 through, finally clicking, oh dear, this doctor's a bit sinister. And then when you go back and look through, it's that there are loads and loads of clues about the evil doctor. Do you know anything about evil doctors, Eamon?
I refuse to answer on the grounds I might incriminate myself, Pete. Yes.
What about yourself? How long did it take for you to get it, or can you not remember?
I thought it was a very cinematic, again, a very cinematic ploy to have him start by telling his story to somebody. And I guess I think it would be about the same as you, Pete. And about 3/4 of the way through, I realised that there's more to the doctor than meets the eye.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's something when the doctor starts to try and drug his drink. And there's a nasty little trip there that sort of plays into it. But, you know, it was brilliantly done. Interesting, you mentioned the sort of 5 or 6 page episodes that we get in the prog. But when you read it through, I didn't notice the jumps at all.
Not a bit, I know.
This reads so seamlessly, doesn't it? Yep. Just straight on. And it's so well done.
It's brilliant. There was a few little clues that I spotted on this read that I don't think I'd spotted before. So if we're kind of, I assume everybody that listens to this sort of read the book, so we're not given spoilers away.
Yes, spoilers.
but if you look at page one, there's sort of Dr. L. Spalding, I think he's called.
That's
Leonard
him, yes.
Spalding. And when we get our second fight in the Welsh Valleys, I think it is, Dr. Leonard Spalding's there, but his face is covered by sort of binoculars, by one of the, because I think the four voices stand and watch, or the,
they're on a hillside watching with binoculars.
And this, one of them says Leonard at one point, but he's kind of got something obscure in his face. And when I read it this time, I was thinking, oh, that's him. That's Leonard.
Well, you've got yourself a good one there, Leonard. Damn your hide. You'll take a check, of course.
And then early on in the book, I think it's in a phone call between sort of Harry and his voice. He says, "You're a cold fish, Harry," which is why we said it, I think, at the start. And then a bit later on in the book, because that's quite a quirky little phrase, isn't it?
Yes.
And later on in the book, the doctor says to him, "You're a cold fish, Harry." And you'd think, oh, man.
I've heard that phrase before.
Yes. There was one particularly sort of beautiful panel where Harry's talking about his voice being a real sickle and seeing how he really gets off on this kind of stuff. And he says, "Do you know what I mean, Doc?" And you just get a real sort of close-up on the doctor's eyes, sort of closed, sort of quite erotically, and he goes, "Yes." And, you see, and like, that was a, you know, standout panel for me. It was brilliant. Oh, I love it. One of the things that I thought about a lot as I read it is Arthur Ranson's artwork always seems to have like a, despite the book being 30 seconds in the hour future, but as you said, this was 1992, heavens above. It still has quite a 70s or 80s vibe, doesn't it?
It does. It has that sort of hard man from the 70s feel, like the, you know, like a Get Carter or the Sweeney or something like that.
And certainly lots of the characters have that kind of vibe. So his friend Carl, who gets him into the game, he's like a real sort of 70s kind of cockney sort of wide boy, isn't he?
A leery lad who gets him involved. And then, yes. And, of course, we get these wonderful locations as well. It's from the farm, and then there's the sort of battle in Wales, and then foggy London.
That's a standout sequence, isn't it? I was lucky enough at one of the conventions, John Wagner does a talk on his writing process.
Oh, right.
And he has like a PowerPoint that goes along, and he talks through that sequence. And so whenever I read that part of the book, it always gives us a thrill. So I've seen John Wagner talk about this, but that foggy London is great, isn't it? It's the most atmospheric artwork I can think of, I think.
It's amazing. And as you say, it's got that, you know, he's there in a seedy pub. It does look like something out of the 70s, doesn't it?
Yeah, like a carry-on film.
But turns rather nasty. I'm looking at a beautiful sort of one-page splash by Arthur Ranson of this sort of foggy alleyway in London with the street lights.
Exactly the one.
It's beautiful stuff, isn't it?
And with us talking about the 70s, in that sequence, the wallpaper that sort of...
Oh, yes.
The Ringo comes out of with his axe. It's that 70s sort of...
Nursery wallpaper, yeah. Oh, dear. Yes, those little kids, that's right. Those little sort of ragamuffin kids.
Yeah, it's lovely. In this particular sequence, when Harry puts Ringo on the tracks, the terror in his face is incredible.
Yes.
There are certain artists, aren't there, who could win Oscars for the acting that they put on a page.
Yeah.
And certainly Arthur Ranson would get the Oscar for best acting in this strip.
It's quite amazing. Arthur Ranson, I mean, he comes from Lookin magazine in the 70s, doing those television adaptations for Lookin magazine.
Tina Turner story and everything.
And that's right, ABBA comic. And then he does Judge Anderson. I think Judge Anderson's the first thing he does for the prog, and then he does this, and it's... I mean, well, the Anderson thing itself, or these Anderson stories, are fantastic. But the artwork here is just sublime, isn't it?
It is. It is possibly some of my favourite 2000 AD artwork ever.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the while, Harry is killing his way through the game. But at the same time, he's getting closer and closer to finding out who his voice is, because he sort of wants out, doesn't he?
Yeah. The way that he kind of decides that almost seems quite flippant, doesn't it? His decision just comes...
like, I've had enough of this.
Yeah, it comes after Ringo says you can't leave the game, and it's almost like...
we'll see
about
that.
Rebel. Yeah, he needs to rebel. And that's when we get our glorious snake and badger.
Yes, sequence. Absolutely, yes. Because as you say, you know, as he's been described, he's a cold fish, Harry Exton. He's a lethal killer. He's a very 70s hard man in his leather jacket. Yeah, he's not altogether likable. I mean, you know, he's the anti-hero of anti-heroes, isn't he?
I love the introduction to the game. It's one of my favourite sequences in all of comicdom, where Harry answers the phone in the middle of the night, and there's that guy with the kind of night vision goggles. That's a terrifying kind of image, and he's just shooting at him.
Yes.
And he's unarmed. But there's a favourite panel where it's just the dial from the telephone. I think that's why this thing reminds us of the 70s so much. But that looks like a real telephone dial.
It does, doesn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
A good old rotary dial.
Yeah, and the clock, I think we had the exact same clock, a little alarm clock that's, I think, on the same page.
Yes, Loris brand.
Yeah.
I remember those with the little sort of luminous hands. Yeah, it's 3:10 in the morning and the phone rings on the farm and Harry is in the game whether he likes it or not.
Amazing. And Harry in the barn is quite terrifying, isn't he? He's quite sort of, when he gets the guy and he's standing over him with the pitchfork, it's just a terrifying image. He's so powerful, isn't he?
He is, yes.
Fantastic.
I mean, throughout the three books, when he's cornered, he's at his most dangerous, isn't he? And he's ruthless, he's dangerous. Because, I mean, the bit we haven't mentioned yet, but people probably know, that one of the rules of the game is that if you're trapped by your opponent, you can offer up your marker, which is that you have to give them the sort of like two joints of a finger. They take cut off part of your finger, which is the way they can prove that they've beaten you. And if you've lost three fingers, you're out of the game for good. And of course, Harry will get into trouble various points throughout the book because people will offer him, say, take my marker. And Harry will say, no.
It's fantastic. So then the climax of the book is the 4-1 battle in Monkey House Film and Theatre Properties. That's Ranson at his best, isn't it? That spooky house with all those sort of gargoyle-esque monkeys.
Now, is that based on one of the Hammer Horror Studio houses or something like that? I wonder if that was what that was supposed to be. It's that sort of place, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I was trying to Google that last night to get a better reference, but I think it obviously is, isn't it?
It's something like the Bray Studios for Hammer Horror with this old, creepy old stately home that's full of dark corners and places to hide. And yeah, and as you say, it's the rest of the Button Man have been sent in against Harry. But once he's in a tight spot, well, he just gets more dangerous, doesn't he?
That's right. And speaking of tight spots, he manages to sneak a couple of extra bullets in, doesn't he?
He does, yes, that's right, because they have a limit on how many bullets they can have in this particular one. They set up various rules before some of these contests in the game, and in this one they're limited to how many bullets, and his opponents are counting his bullets. But yes, Harry's snuck in a couple of extras somewhere where the sun doesn't shine.
And then a bit later on, gets shot with one of them.
You're going to need antibiotics, I tell you.
Yeah. Again, the characterization here is great. So there's one of these Button Men is known as the Preacher, and he's just a nasty piece of work, isn't he?
Yes.
Really, really chilling, horrible man. An Irish Jerry, just plain George.
Yes, they all have, as you say, throughout the three books, they have sort of like distinctive characters and names. They're most of them entirely loathsome. I mean, as you say, his friend Carl is perhaps the only sort of cheerful one.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, he comes to a sticky end as well.
Yeah, that's awful. Not so much fun for the listener, but just the page I've got up at the moment has got a one of those 80s-esque, 70s-esque electric bar fire things.
Yes.
Just seeing things like that just blows your mind, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And throwing a little bit of light in this strange manor house where they've gathered to discuss the rules of the game before the contest starts. Yeah, fabulous stuff. And of course, it's going to bring us then to the doctor's office and heading towards the resolution.
Yeah, and there you get some beautifully trippy panels, don't you, of once the doctor's drugged poor Harry, and you see all the distortions and reality gets warped. That's a wonderful set of panels, reminiscent of that Bolland Dread cover all those years ago, where Dread was kind of...
When Judge Lopez had the Oracle spells.
Totally reminded us of that. But Harry, again, ever the hard man and won't compromise, so he had a chance of playing this game where they could wound each other.
Yep.
And they would be out, or it was just four against one, where there would be last man standing, and of course... That's the one that Harry chooses. Just a bastard, isn't he?
he's hard as nails, isn't he?
He certainly is. He certainly is.
And completely ruthless killer. Now, Arthur Ranson, in his introduction to this volume, and I think he's mentioned this in interviews elsewhere, he does mention that he made a slight change at the end of book one. Have you ever wondered what that might have been? I just wonder whether John Wagner intended at the end of book one that Harry would die.
Yeah.
And whether Arthur Ranson talked him out of it and actually said, no, this could actually be a runner.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so I wonder if that's what that was.
I think it must have been.
Because he is, as you say, he's been wounded. He's bleeding to death in this doctor's surgery. And then, of course, he's drugged as well. So it's not going terribly well for Harry. And we get all this beautiful imagery of the jaguar you mentioned. And, of course, the doctor's tropical fish as well.
Yeah. And that last page of the, just the murder scene is awful, isn't it? It's horrific.
It is. It's very gruesome. And it's also rather beautifully done by Arthur Ranson again. Yes, the last page of book one is fabulous. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I think you're right, because I seem to remember being blown away by this when I first read it many, many, many years ago, and being slightly bit disappointed when there was going to be a Button Man 2, because it was a beautifully contained story, and in my head, Harry had died. It was sort of Super Surf 13 all over again, or whatever it was.
He died in the end.
Yep, definitely. But, you know, I'm glad that they developed it, because what we got from this was brilliant as well. But this book one is just perfect, isn't it? It's a wonderful story.
It is. It's stunning throughout. As you say, the characters are great. The story is fantastic, very gripping. And then the Ranson's art, the locations, we've mentioned the wildlife, but also his acting, his face acting is brilliant. Yep. So, wonderful book one of Button Man. Takes us to Button Man book two, where we change locale altogether.
So we'll go to the USA, where everything is bigger and better.
And more expensive. More deadly.
10 times the money, give or take. So I think it mentions in book one, £20,000. And then I think in book two, we get $200,000 per match.
Right.
That made us giggle. So again, this was a different sort of... It was a change in the storytelling, wasn't it? So instead of the confession being a verbal confession, we get this written confession, don't we? Which is another great storytelling sort of idea.
Yes, that's right. We get the, as you say, the actual written confession of Harry Exton as it goes along. We see bits more of it as it tells parts of the story, because he's been patched up and he's been shipped off to America because an American... politician who's a voice in the American game wants him as a Button Man over there. And as you say, the stakes are higher, the money's higher. It's all not going to go very well, is it?
And it's lovely because it sort of starts off where the other book left off. So we'll see how Harry gets out of the hospital. dream sequences are used throughout these books, aren't they? And we get to see some lovely recaps of the previous story. Some stunning pages of Arthur Ranson's artwork as Harry sort of goes in and out of lucidity. But when he wakes up in America with a wife.
Yes, with the lovely Cora, I believe, is it? Yes.
The lovely Cora, she's gorgeous.
Yes.
and is very confused. And again, it's a wonderfully cinematic way to start the story, or a wonderfully intriguing way to start the story. So yes, we get introduced to Boss Hogg, AJ, the senator, and Harry gets stupidly drawn back into the game.
Yes, he's back in again, although he wanted to be out, but he's back in the game. The money, he's going to get paid more, and he's as successful as ever. There's a wonderful sequence where he's kitted out with some James Bond gear as well, isn't there?
Yeah, the pen and the watch.
And the stabby shoes.
Yeah.
The watch where you pull out a garrotting wire from the winder. Yeah, very James Bond, very Q.
Yeah, it's funny. And Harry's back in the game because this time he does get to meet his voice beforehand, which is obviously very important to him. So he's in control a bit. And then the first match is spectacular. In the Natural History Museum, in public.
Yes, that's right, a public location. There he is. He doesn't know who he's going to meet and fight. And it's one of these occasions when they pull the rug out from under us because you're walking around thinking, who is it?
Yeah.
And they totally caught me on this one.
Yeah. The guy walking out of an elevator and who looks like he would be a button man.
Yes. It's a very nasty looking piece of work, walks out and you think, yeah, it must be him, but nope.
Nope, it's the creepy looking security guard that's hidden his carnation as well. Scumbag.
Yes, that's right. For this one, they were to wear a red carnation as a marker to see who it was, yeah. And of course, he makes the mistake not only of missing Harry, but then also of pissing Harry off as well. So.
Oh, yes. And again, we get to see how cold Harry is because he uses a bunch of school children on a school visit.
Yeah.
It's the kind of distraction to smack Arnold in the face and start shooting with loads of children around. And it's just inconceivable, isn't it?
It is, absolutely, yes.
We've talked a lot about Arthur's cinematic style, but his panel layouts are like a masterclass of storytelling as well, aren't they? So at the end of book one, when Harry's sort of under the influence of the drugs, you have panels that are all sort of lopsided and wonky and all of this. When he attacks the doctor with a knife, your panels are all kind of cut up and get sort of, the cuts get more severe. But then in this sequence in the museum, as the chaos starts, the panels go all over the place, and it's just so clever. I would love a brain like that could see this before it happens and make it happen. It's just stunning.
Yes, absolutely, yes. I suppose in cinematic terms, it's almost like a Dutch tilt on the camera when, you know, things start, the action starts, and suddenly, as you say, we've got panels at different angles and chaos and confusion in the museum. Kids involved, a running gun battle through them. Oh, yeah, it's tremendous.
It is.
Then ending up, I presume, is that Central Park they're ending
up in? It is,
yeah. Nearby the Alice in Wonderland statues.
Beautiful, yep.
Looks like you win, Limey. You'll take my marker? No can do.
I just don't like you, Arnold.
Oh dear. Harry Exton is, as you say, he's a hard and nasty man, isn't he?
He's awful. Awful. and then we get to see some of, I love the relationship between Harry and Cora because she's a different kind of cold fish, isn't she? She is willing to do anything to keep this going and to keep our lifestyle going, so she has no morals whatsoever.
No, that's right. The devastatingly attractive Cora, who's his sort of minder and liaison between him and his voice, and patches him up after his battles, but also passes on the messages from the senator that he's to ease off a bit on some of the other voices, button men. Ease up a bit, that's all he asks. But you think, yeah, it doesn't sound like our Harry, does it?
Not a bit.
No.
So battle two of this book takes place, I think, 42nd Street. And again, that's...
Is that in the meat locker?
No, this is the cinema.
Oh, yes, of course, right.
So we have a Dracula film shown, and as Dracula sort of gets one victim on screen, Harry gets his in the cinema, using some of his James Bond-esque gadgets.
Oh, yes, I remember. Yes, I'm seeing it now.
Yeah, this is just a beautifully short scene, but the dialogue on screen in the cinema matches the action on the page, and that's just beautifully written. But then we get the meat locker with Falco.
Falco, yes.
Yes, where Harry does go slightly easier.
Takes a marker, finally, yes. Yeah, that's a nasty battle there. And again, another cinematic sequence that sort of brings us back to Rocky when he was training by public meat. So, yes, in a meat locker, and another win for Harry. But this time he does take a marker. Although in a rather brutal fashion again.
Yeah, it's awful. The knife he uses is a big, horrible electric carving knife, and it just sends shivers down my spine to look at it. Well, one of the things that I'd written in my notes now, I think, was Arthur Ranson's use of sound effects is similarly brilliant, how he incorporates his sound effects into the page. So often when bits of glass are flying, and there's lots of flying glass in the book, it's not the letter that's done the sound effects, it's Arthur's actually put them in. And similarly with this knife here, we just get like a Z as it gets switched on.
It's a very clever panel there, actually, because it just takes over the whole panel, and the camera sort of pans away, and you think, yep, I know what's going on there. Yeah, and our mind makes it worse because we can't see it. Yeah, it is actually it's tremendous stuff that he does throughout with sound effects, actually, now that you've mentioned it.
It was something that I'd noticed this read, particularly, whenever glass gets shattered, which is a lot, you get that. Lots of lovely sound effects sort of built into the artwork. It's lovely. And then we get one of my favourite battles, which is a four-man button man match in Arizona.
Some sort of abandoned cowboy town or film set.
Yeah, film set, I think, yeah. And this is Harry being at his most extreme, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And the characters here are great. So there's one button man he takes a particular dislike to called Crow.
Absolutely, because he spits on his neat white trainers.
And that's a dirty habit.
It is a terrible habit, yes.
And he apologises, says, real sorry, and Harry says, you will be.
Yeah.
And we get on this, I'm looking at the page now, and you just get a flashback to the doctor's head in the fish tank, and then it's back to the action. And I remember now when I was looking at this page, I was going to ask you, it appears that Crow looks of sort of American Indian kind of descent.
Yeah.
And you see him kind of looking into Harry's eyes in the next panel. I don't know if you've got the page up now.
I have, yes, I've got that.
And I wondered if it was some kind of mystical sort of connection, or if you just think that's in Harry's mind.
Well, it's interesting. It's that weird little narrow panel.
Yeah.
The flashback to the doctor's head in this sort of jaggedy red flashback, as you say, whether or not it's Crow seeing something in Harry or whether it's Harry,
just Harry.
Having his own little mini flashbacks. Because as you say, there are dream recaps and flashbacks in these books. It's a gruesome little moment, isn't it?
Yep. But this whole fight is... It's really good, isn't it? Harry absolutely controls it, cleverly using one of the beaten button men as a human shield.
Yep.
And then at the end, he gets the drop on Crow.
Absolutely, yes.
and he should take his marker. But instead chooses to throw him from the roof of the building, much to the annoyance of AJ, who has now had to forfeit the match.
Yes, he really annoys his voice this time because rather than take Crow's marker, he tosses him off the roof. That's a real nasty habit you've got there, spitting. Yeah. So, yes, this is where he and his senator start to... there are differences, I think, between them from this point on.
A real filthy habit you've got there of spitting. I'm going to cure you of it. And he throws him off the building. And that's a beautiful page as well. We'll get to see quite a gruesome end for Crow.
Yeah.
But the final panel is this sort of a long panel of Harry on the roof, and it sort of covers the entire height of the page, and it's just great.
Yes, well, the senator says, I must confess I've been a little worried about Harry. Something will have to be done.
And the book takes a turn for the worst.
It does, yes. After a little bit of R&R with the lovely Cora, we get this full page I'm looking at now. Another, like, dream sequence. I had another nightmare. They've been getting worse.
Yeah.
And this full page Arthur Ranson page of one of Harry's nightmares, flashback to things that gone before and a portent of things to come. It's all quite grim, and Crow has become almost like a literal crow in this one, hasn't he? Yes,
and we've got a kind of undead army
chasing Carl by the looks of it. Yes.
And then him is it one of the others in the bottom corner.
I wonder if that's supposed to be him. Yes.
Yeah.
If he's seeing himself, the sort of like the skull beneath the skin. I always look at these books and wonder if I could own any of the pages of art, which one would I have? There's that page. There's also at the start of book two, there's another sort of dream sequence where they recap almost the entire part of book one in one page.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely one as well. But these full page images are fantastic, aren't they?
Yes. Arthur Ranson did the best work ever. I loved his Anderson, but this, as you said, this was just a cut above again.
And then Harry gets a friend.
Oh, yeah. And that's lovely because he goes from cold Harry, so he doesn't like people. But he's certainly fond of dogs, isn't he?
He likes his dog, yes. A dog sort of wanders into the sort of estate he lives on, and Harry adopts this dog, and it stays with him right the way to book three.
Great. And once again, the introduction of the dog's quite a tense moment as well, because you think something, you know, AJ's just said something has to be done, and then someone or something is sneaking about outside of Harry's house in the dead of night, and you think, right, that's a button man.
Yep.
And it turns out to be this lovely dog, and it's just great. And he even says, doesn't he, I guess you always know where you are, where you stand with an animal. And then Cora betrays him, doesn't she?
She does, yes. The senator has decided that something must be done about Harry, and the next thing he knows, there are people coming for him, and Cora has sold him down the river, as we sort of thought she might do, to be honest, if she got the chance. But of course, Cora had her own little insurance policy that Harry knew about, and he manages to track it down, and it becomes as part of the confession that we've been seeing throughout this book.
And then we get another wonderful sequence in a barn, a killing in a barn.
Another one, yes. Yes, don't put Harry Exton in a barn.
The sort of the lighting in this scene is brilliant. And there's a panel of Harry standing over the cop with his gun, and it's all sort of dark and it's sort of uplit, and it just looks amazing. He looks so terrifying.
And obviously the characters don't know about Harry Exton like we know him, but whatever you do, don't attack Harry's dog. Things are not going to go well for you if you do, are they?
Exactly.
Splendid stuff. And of course, Harry's on the run now from his senator, but he's not on the run for very long. He'll be coming back. And of course, that's exactly what happens to build up to the final sequence of book two, which is Harry's assault on the senator's own, huge sort of...
mansion.
Yes, huge Florida mansion in the sort of like the Everglades, I guess. Which again allows Arthur Ranson to really beautiful stuff. The sequences in the swamp with the wildlife again.
Yeah, we get the wildlife. And again, it kind of hints back, doesn't it, to the wildlife in Book One. I think we see the crocodile attacking the prey.
Yes,
a few times.
Yeah, the heron, a beautiful image of a heron or something similar by itself. And then there's a crocodile takes it.
And the bits with the sort of the searchlights of the helicopter in the swamp are just beautiful.
Absolutely, yes. The way the light flies through that sort of Spanish moss on the trees. Lovely. And then, of course, as they say, you know, make a film 90 minutes and have a helicopter exploding and you're on to a winner. Yeah. And so they deliver here with a very impressive vadoom sound effect. He got the chopper that levels the odds.
Yeah.
He is a killing machine and he's heading for the senator, but he's got a point to prove. So, and it neatly wraps up, I suppose, towards the end of book two, because he's now got his insurance, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I think that's what I love about this series, particularly book two and book three. The wrap up so beautifully. He wins. Or you think he wins? He outsmarts everyone and manages to get out.
Yes.
So in this one, he has the insurance, thanks to Cora, and says to the senator that insurance is with several reputable lawyers, and if they don't hear from him each month, then that'll be released to the press.
Yes, fantastic stuff to end book two, and Harry apparently driving away from the game again.
Yes.
And actually for a bit longer this time, as I said, this was 94, so we got about 6 or 7 years before it comes back to the prog.
Yeah, but it's worth a mention in book two that Cora's not going to let him go, is she?
No. Take me with you, Harry.
Yeah, and then she tries to kill him.
Yeah.
And E.G. gets her.
Yes, it doesn't. Things don't end well for the lovely Cora.
No.
Who's been a bit of a rum un since the start when she was introduced. But there you go.
Conniving to the end. And then we have the glorious book three.
Yes, so tell us about book three.
So book three, we have Harry's managed to start a new life away in the mountains, away from all the button men, and sort of a life almost of solitude, just with a Vietnam vet Wiley kicking about now and again. But he seems to have found peace, but not for long. He's having an affair with Grace Wyatt, the dentist's wife, who's stunning.
Yes.
And he seems to have won. And then we hear on the radio that AJ's chopper has crashed and he's dead. And Harry thinks that that's the last link to the game gone. Unfortunately, his death means that the voices can get to him again because his insurance is gone.
Yes, the remaining voices now can come after Harry because he's cost them so much money over the years.
Yep.
And they turn it into another one of their bizarre and macabre contests by sending basically all of their button men to hunt down Harry.
But it's a bit more high tech this time, isn't it? It's GPS trackers, and we have like a war room almost showing where Harry is and where the other button men are and which ones are left and all of that. It's a lot more of an organised contest this time, isn't it?
Yes, it is. As you say, they've got this sort of central control room that they track the game from, and they've somehow managed to get a tracker onto Harry somehow, and that's giving away his GPS location the whole time, so they can send their button men after him. And every time Harry thinks he's given them the slip, well, there's another button man around the corner, it seems.
And what an horrible way to do it. So we find out that the voices tip off the dentist that Harry is messing about with his wife, and so the dentist, who looks terribly creepy as well, manages to hide the GPS in Harry's tooth in a filling in a really one of the more gruesome sequences of the book, and it's just a fill-in.
Yes, if you're bothered by the Laurence Olivier in Marathon Man sequence, then you probably won't like this couple of pages from 2000 AD in the prog back in 2001. Yes.
I wonder if Wagner's got a thing for dentists, because we've got Sydney Death Star as well, haven't we?
Absolutely, yeah.
Similar panels where you got sort of views from the inside of the victim's mouths. Not nice.
Yeah. The most close-ups you'll see of dental work in a comic. But there you go. So, yes, they've managed to get a tracker onto him. And actually, I think Harry, he takes quite a while to figure it out, but he does eventually figure it out and use it to his advantage. He managed to turn it.
I think I wasn't quite as slow with this one. I think I'd got it a few weeks before Harry.
Right.
This time, if I remember rightly. One of the things I was thinking is that a director or a film producer in this group of voices, and his name is Stephen D'Souza.
Oh, right, yep.
And I wondered, is that a play on either Brian De Palma or the writer of the Stallone Dread movie was William D'Souza.
Oh, right. Oh,
sorry,
okay.
This is Stephen De Silva, this one, sorry. And when I read that, I wondered if that was a little puppet, this Stephen D'Souza.
The writer of the Stallone. Yeah. Right.
Could be. I must say that was the only bit of this book that I didn't like. Because he's on sort of chat shows and things talking about this film he's making called Killer Killer.
Yeah.
And how the voices have the button men, and you think, no, too much. You're ruining the realism a bit.
Yes.
There. I didn't like it. It was a plot device for Harry to recognise his voice so I can see why it was done. But I wish, it had been a bit more subtle than that somehow. So in this particular version of the game, you're right, we have 13 button men all after Harry, one of whom is called Ugly John, and it's just a grotesque character. So I love the setup in this book. So once the Senate is gone and it looks like Harry's going to be happy for the first time, I was really rooting for him and the dentist's wife, Grace. And as he goes to see her in the diner that she works or owns, you get the button men coming in a sequence that was very reminiscent of A History of Violence, I thought.
Yes, it is. And, of course, Harry recognises them because they're short a finger joint or two. And he instantly puts two and two together and realises.
And he knows.
Yeah.
But I love Ugly John's sort of obnoxious sort of dialogue when he's ordering his breakfast, and he goes, crackleberries. That's what his papa used to call eggs or something, crackleberries. And that just, when you read that, just kind of, it sounds so cool.
Yes, he's loud and he's uncouth. Exactly. Yeah. He's irredeemably nasty. And of course, he's going to be dogging Harry's trail right the way through to the final sequences of this book, isn't he? Yeah. He's the one that you think is going to come the closest to getting him.
Yeah. I quite like his partner as well. So the ordering breakfast, and he's just a man of few words, so thick set.
Yeah.
Looks every bit the thug, and he cheeseburger, fries for breakfast.
As you say from last time, it'd be lovely to actually see some of John Wagner's scripts for this and how much of the of this is the teamwork between Wagner and Ranson and who's doing what. It's beautiful stuff.
It really is. So the two men put the frighteners on Harry in another fantastic sort of at nighttime scene, which kind of echoes the first button man attack of book one. So shooting at Harry through his windows of his house. And so for Harry, the game's on.
Yes, and then he gets the phone call that tells him he's no longer safe.
Yeah.
They're on to him and he's got to run. And so he thinks he can elude them and he does go on the run. But of course, everywhere he goes, it goes wrong.
This is very much the Hunter's Game, isn't it? Or the Hunter's Club, sorry, from Dread.
Yes.
which has always been a favourite as well.
And there's also Harry checking into like American roadside motels, which there's a sequence which is very much like No Country for Old Men, I thought.
Yeah.
If you've seen that film, where, you know, with the nastiness of them sort of killer tracking down the guy in that, and then you got Ugly John on the trail of Harry here.
Just great. And I remember the swear word that was used, one fucking bad FBI, and he says one fucking bad individual.
That's
and
it.
I think that
yes.
was the first. Was that the first ever swear word, or the first use of the F word?
Was it
the only use of the F word in 2000 AD? And I remember being sort of shocked to see it. And I think they got a few letters about it after as well. But it just fits, doesn't it, with the brash and obnoxious, loud, horrible character that he is.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
That killer is chilling as well, isn't he?
Yes, because he's talking to the poor boy who runs the motel, and he says, do you think you'd recognise me if you see me again?
Yeah.
And I'm willing this poor guy to say no.
Yeah.
Couldn't pick you out. But of course the poor kid says, yes sir, I could sure remember you. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And then a bit later on we get the news report that says that he was disemboweled.
Oh,
I think,
good.
Dear
yeah,
me.
I know.
A real nasty, nasty moment there from Mr. Wagner.
We do get, actually, that's right, the voices, we find out that other voices have difficulty controlling their button men as well.
Yeah.
Because they've been told to keep collateral damage down to a minimum. But these are people who are individuals who actually quite like the nastiness, the killing, don't they?
Yeah.
Bunch of reprehensible psychos, the whole lot of them.
And then we get to meet Frankie. Frankie gets alluded to earlier on in the book, doesn't she? Well, you don't get the gender, but that maniac Frankie, and, you know, rightly or wrongly, get quite a surprise when Frankie turns out to be quite an attractive young lady.
Another misdirect by Wagner and Ranson, and she gets to drop on Harry, and it all looks like it's going to go wrong. Except there's too many button men around and they sort of get in each other's way, don't they?
They certainly do. And a poor civilian as well.
Yes, a jogger gets caught.
And his dialogue throughout. So he's in absolute agony on the floor as this chaos is going on all around. And it's just awful to read as it's all
terrible,
going on.
Yeah.
But we get a real flash of Harry's cruelty here, don't we? With Frankie, when she shows him a photograph of her kids and begs him not to kill her. But before that, she's sort of said to him that he's going to pay for their college fees. And she says, please, Harry, remember my kids. And he says, how could I forget? I'm the one that was going to put them through college. And just blows her brains out.
Oh, dear, awful. Shocking. Yes. When we get to see the blood fall on the photograph, yeah. And he's taken a number of button men out of the game, but then we get to see another brief sort of like drive-by of Ugly John, who's still dogging him. Yeah. And it's quite, I mean, the colour work, we talked about colour work last time on America changing, because we've gone from bright, open sort of American spaces to a very gritty inner city, almost like film noir for this sequence, this chase in a city. He can do it all, Arthur Ranson, really, can't he? He certainly can.
Yeah, in my notes, I'd written that book one was like a wonderful study of Britain, and book two and book three are a beautiful study of the USA with, you know, all the different sort of environments visited.
Yes.
And this is just great.
Yes, he does. He takes Harry on the road, on a road trip across America, but he's going to double back on himself and head back to where it's sort of to where he was hiding out at the start of book three,
where he takes control again, isn't it? It mirrors book, well, all of the books, doesn't it?
Yes,
that he kind of takes control 2/3 of the way through and tips the game in his favour.
He does, yes. And then we get a very cinematic sequence of a motorbike and a truck, don't we?
Yeah. I never knew how I felt about that that sequence, to be honest. I liked the sort of gritty realness of the strip, and that got a little bit too action movie-esque for us to leap out of the back of a truck onto the bonnet of a car. And
did make for a very nice cover by Kevin Walker.
Yes, it certainly did, I know. Yes. You can't help but think of that, can you?
Yeah.
And then just one of the worst scenes ever of him when he finally clicks that the track is in his tooth, and there's only one way to get it out.
Yes.
And that's with a pair of pliers at the roadside. And you see the muscles straining in his neck as he's pulling at his own molar. It's just awful. And then instead of throwing the tracker away or putting it on the back of a train or whatever, which is what we would have done, Harry decides to hang on to it.
He has a plan. Yeah, Wagner again has is two jumps ahead, and he's got a plan as to what he's going to do with this tracker, and he's going to lead them back to his own hunting grounds where he started book three, as I said. And we'll get the last of the Button Men in a final showdown, where it does actually look pretty bad for Harry, doesn't it? You know, this
it certainly does.
He takes more of a beating in this final confrontation than we've seen him ever before. They do tag him a couple of times, and it looks like he's down on a couple of occasions, but he keeps coming back.
It's an awful ending for poor Wiley.
Yes, his friend who sort of blunders back into it to try and help out after Harry had warned him to stay away.
And he gets done by one of Harry's own traps.
Yeah.
And we see Harry lose it a bit there, don't we?
Yes.
Start shouting at the body. One of the bits of this book that I forgot to mention, which I absolutely loved, right at the start of this book, Harry seems to stare down a bear.
He does, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd forgotten that, yes.
So I've just been talking about how I appreciate the sort of the reality of this book, the gritty reality of it. But there is a beautiful sequence where the bear rises up, and he just rises up as well, and the bear thinks, nope, I'm not taking him on.
That's right. You see a panel of the bear's eyes, then a panel of Harry's eyes, and then the bear goes back down on all fours and lopes away.
And on those panels, Harry's are by far the scariest, aren't they?
Absolutely. And then as he's thinking to himself, you know, the game, you never escape the game. Yeah.
But then, we have what is it, 8v1?
I think so, yeah, something like that, in the forests with Harry's traps and snowmobiles and a certain amount of ultraviolence.
But you're right, this is sort of Harry's killing grounds, and he knows it so well.
Yes, he does, and he's got some tricks up his sleeve. He does the trick with the grenade that he hasn't pulled the pin from, just to make them dive out of the way and get the drop on them. Yeah,
and Ugly John's there till the bitter end, and is as obnoxious as ever. So is there an Asian man called Gino?
Yep.
And he calls him Odd Job throughout.
It's Gan, I think, isn't
Gan,
he?
Calls
him Odd Job throughout. And then at the end, Gan phones it in. They're all dead. Doc, Luger, Monks, Ratman and Ugly John, Boomer, Sabbath.
Is that the page of just bodies?
It is. It's a page of just
absolute carnage.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Particularly Boomer, who's just an arm.
And poor Doc, I'm very upset. Poor Doc didn't make it. No,
I know. I was rooting for him. Yeah. And then again, another just ingenious ending from Mr. Wagner, who again manages to pull the rug from the voices this time. So he allows Gan to live, throws the tracker into the bottom of a lake, and gives him his marker.
Cuts off his own finger.
Oh, yeah. So Gan gets to win, but Harry gets to walk away.
Harry gets to go walk away from the game, and that ends book three.
Or does it? Because there's a beautiful epilogue where that horrible killer director gets his
Michael gets De Silva.
Yep.
The singular distinction of being nominated for an Oscar and questioned by the Chicago police on the same day. And I managed to get down to LA the following spring.
He blew his brains out.
Yeah.
We'll find out the fate of the dentist.
Yes.
The voices, looks like the voices got him wiped out. And poor, I would have liked to have seen Harry get it on with the dentist's wife at the end, but it was never to be.
No.
And then there's just that brilliant final page of Harry really wiping out his last link to the game, and that's by feeding poor Gan to a crocodile in a real shocking, got a bunch of crocodiles, that's so cold.
There he is, Harry X, the ruthless killer extraordinaire, right to the end, the complete anti-hero. Yes, you do almost want him to be played by Michael Caine back in the 60s and 70s, yeah. Don't you? Yes.
Oh, yeah. I can see it. I can really see it. Loads of those characters. I loved Carl. I'm sure there were a load of those sort of 70s black actors that would have made brilliant Carls. He was a real favourite character of mine. I was very upset when he...
You were rooting for him.
Yeah. But he whispers a name, doesn't he, to Harry?
Yep. Who sets Harry on the trail.
But yes, what a... Just an absolute masterclass of storytelling that whole book is, isn't it?
Absolutely, it is. I mean, the whole thing, as you say, by Wagner is just superlative writing throughout plotting and characters and dialogue. And you mentioned History of Violence, which was 1997. And that gets made into a movie in 2005, I've got down here in my notes. But, you know, if I was going to pick up a John Wagner property for a movie, I would have gone for this one.
Yeah.
I know David Cronenberg said that he didn't actually know that it was a comic book before it was, you know, a screenplay.
Right.
So he didn't know anything about it. But whoever picked that property up, I would have gone for Button Man myself.
Me too. So let's hope that we'll get it in some form. Have you read A History of Violence?
I have, yes.
It's very different, though. You know, the film was kind of book one, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
But it misses the whole...
book two, well, it would have been quite a different film altogether.
Yeah, I know. Really, really amazing. I know I would love to see Button Man made into a film. Sadly, it has been. There's a film called The Tournament with Robert Carlyle.
I do remember a trailer for that a long time ago.
Yeah, that is basically ripped off Button Man big style.
Right, okay.
It's got Vin Rhames, is he called?
From Pulp Fiction and Mission Impossible.
And it's more Button Man Book 3. It's a bunch of killers and they've all got to wipe each other out. They've all got GPSs inside them.
Right.
So that the backers back in the war room can see what's happening where. And I think the explosive sort of GPS chips as well. So if somebody breaks the rules, they can blow them up. So it's very much the Hunters Club as well. So something else that I think 2000 AD should have a look at. Although this is creator-owned. I did mention it to John a while back. It is, that said, you might not want to watch that film, John, because it might make you a bit cross. I haven't read it for this tonight, but there was, of course, Button Man Book 4, which we can't not mention. For me, a bit of a flawed story.
That's the Hitman's Daughter,
The Hitman's
isn't it?
Daughter, yeah.
And Fraser Irving takes over on art, and Fiona Staples, who's now so famous for the Saga.
Saga, yeah.
She did the colours, I think.
The artwork's beautiful, but it's different.
Right.
And it was... I really am going for a moment. I've got it in front of us, and I'm actually going to read it. It's probably tonight after this. But it was about another Button Man whose daughter... I think observed the murder of her father by some other Button men, and for some reason thought that Harry X was part of that group. But then I think she's some kind of sort of ninja kind of ninja stars, high kicking sort of babe kind of
Kill Bill
killing machine. Yeah, and it just was a step too far, as I've said annoyingly many times this podcast. It was the love, the realism that I liked, and then when you start having sort of ninjas flying about and didn't sort of grip us as much as books 1 to 3.
Harry X getting caught in a tight spot, yeah, in a barn with a pitchfork and some rope. Yeah. Yeah. So there it is, Button Man, Get Harry X, all three stories collected in one volume. It is available from this book from Amazon for £21, or you can buy the individual books 1, 2, and 3 from the 2000 AD store, or you can get them digitally for £7.99 each on the apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10 devices. At the back, we've got some of the cover images, haven't we, I think, as extras.
Yeah.
So we've got the covers, we've got the introduction by Arthur Ranson. It's a nice package, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely. And an absolute masterclass in comic art and storytelling.
Yes, absolutely. A masterclass in sequentials. I mean, the one thing, the History of Violence book, I didn't really like the art of that at all. No offence to the artist there whose name escapes me.
Vince Locke, I think it
is
was.
Is that it? Right.
Yeah.
Nothing stands up to Arthur Ranson's beautiful visuals, does it?
Even the mighty Fraser Irvine, as I said, it's lovely, this artwork, but it's just...
It's not Arthur Ranson.
It's not Arthur Ranson. And one of my all-time favourite covers, the first cover for the Hitman's Daughter, had kind of her with her ninja stars in a beautiful image. And in a kind of dress, you've got the image of her as a little girl kind of hiding behind her hands. And it was such a brilliant cover. Love that.
Very clever. So, Pete, essential, recommended, or just for the completists?
Essential.
Essential again,
essential.
Yes.
Essential.
You've got to have this one as well, haven't you? If you're a fan of John Wagner, it's some of his finest writing, isn't it?
Definitely.
Outside of the Dread universe, this is some of his finest stuff. And yeah, let's hope it does make it to the screen properly. Whether Netflix or somebody like that will pick it up, we shall see. There's all sorts of rumours.
Yes.
So, Pete, last time gave you the chance to talk about 2000 AD Covers Uncovered. And of course, since then, no sooner did that episode come out than you got catapulted into the stratosphere because something very exciting happened for the blog. Do tell us what's happened to your wonderful blog, Pete.
Yes, I was approached by Tharg the Mighty. He actually beamed into my bedroom when I was trying to sleep and demanded that the blog became an official part of the 2000 AD site.
Fantastic.
And I can't argue with the mighty one. So now each week my insane ramblings will appear on the official 2000 AD website. I've had assurances that I won't be heavily edited, so it'll still be the same mix of dad jokes and terrible puns.
Excellent.
And scat jokes. But it's all official, so I'm just hoping that I get made into a droid very soon, because there's bits of us that are dropping off now.
Yes, we're all desperate to find out what your droid name is going to be, Pete.
So it's a dream come true, all official.
Yes, by appointment to His Royal Thargness up there,
right,
on the 2000 AD site itself, where you can find the Covers Uncovered every week.
Yes.
Breaking down the beautiful work that goes into creating a 2000 AD cover.
Yep, and a big shout out to the lovely Tom Foster, who was the sort of the first ever official one, who has done an amazing, very Bolland-esque Dreads back cover. And I couldn't have asked for a more incredible cover to kick it off.
Yes, and Tom Foster's first cover for the prog, and what a stunner.
Print available to buy as well.
Yes, print available to buy, and you can read all the details about how he created that cover, about his 3D model, about the reference photos. It's all there on your blog posting now on the 2000 AD site.
Hooray!
Yes, hurrah, wonderful stuff. So, Pete, once again, thanks very much for coming on and for bringing such a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading it again. It's absolutely terrific. Do go out and get a copy if you've not got one on your shelf. It's essential stuff.
Very much so. Yeah, I loved reading it as well. It was just... it's a book that keeps on giving.
It does, yes. And reading it through again, there's so much joy in the visuals from Arthur Ranson, and the some of the stuff that you notice on your second or third reading is fantastic. So thank you very much for listening to Mega City Book Club. You too can be like Pete and join me to talk about any 2000 AD book of your choice. You can find out more details because we're now on social media. So please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, check out my Just Giving page, or email me at mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. And you can find all these links at megacitybookclub.com. Thanks to Brian from the British Invaders podcast for hosting Mega City Book Club. If you're interested in British television, science fiction and genre television, then check out the podcast I do with Brian called British Invaders. Intro music is Circuit Breaker by the artist Robodub at the freemusicarchive.org. And as ever, thanks to everybody at 2000 AD and Rebellion for all their splendid books like Get Harry X. As I said, available for mobile devices for the apps for Apple, Android and Windows 10. And thanks again to Pete. So until next time on Mega City Book Club, when we'll be passing judgment on another 2000 AD book, it's goodbye from me and...
good night from the other me.
Thanks very much. Good night.
Thank you. Bye.